Please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. Trustee Harris is excused. Trustee Genrich?
Here.
Trustee Rafter?
Here.
Trustee Van Noven is here. Trustee Dart?
Here.
Trustee Gass?
Here.
Trustee Dennis?
Here.
Are there any suggested modifications to the agenda this evening? Is there anyone visiting us who'd like to see an agenda item moved up or down on the agenda? Yes, sir?
Item 14, I am Darren Adkins, and apparently I've been appointed to a committee yet to be named. I wonder if it's like Harry Potter and I have to put a sorting hat on.
Yes, it is. You have the accent for it, if I may.
21 years here, 15 in Alloway. Figured it was time I got involved.
Okay, we're glad to have you.
And you're okay with, I asked him earlier if he wanted to be moved up, and he said no, he'd just soon stay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to propose that you
vote entirely. I don't mind either way. I'm interested in the process, so I shall remain.
Okay. All right. Anyone else visiting who'd like to see an agenda item moved up or down on the agenda this evening? Okay. Is there a motion? Yes.
I believe there's a correction.
There is a correction. My error under 3C, it should be Cheryl Rainier Wig, not Wig Rainier. And Cheryl's with us this evening.
Any other modifications to the agenda? Is there a motion to approve the agenda as corrected? Trustee Genrich, is there a second? Trustee Dart? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. We'll move on to presentations from Ellers with regard to the TIF district.
Good evening. My name is Greg Johnson. I work with Ellers, and we assisted the village back in 2012 with the creation of its first tax incremental finance district. And I'm here this evening just to kind of give you a brief overview of a little bit of history about the creation of that district and some specifics in terms of how that TID district can be used and some of the ideas and concepts that were discussed here in Alloway when that district was created. I left at each of your places a copy of a handout, which I'll kind of use to summarize my comments this evening. It says tax incremental finance districts frequently asked questions. This is actually a document that we prepared a few years ago when the district was going through the creation and approval process here in Alloway. When the village decided to create the district, about a year of planning and discussion occurred prior to the TID district actually being created. There was participation by local economic groups and business members, the Village Plan Commission, and the Village Board, and several joint meetings were held amongst all those groups to discuss the role and purpose of a TIF district, in Alloway. What a tax incremental finance district is, it's an economic development tool that municipalities use to promote development or redevelopment within a defined geographic boundary. And the primary areas that were identified within the village's TID, and there's a copy of a map of the boundaries a couple pages in within our handout, but they concentrated primarily the Riverside Drive Corridor and the Webster Avenue Corridor as areas for targeting additional development and redevelopment within that geographic area. When a TID district is created, the boundaries are established for that particular district. And I'll explain how the economic and the financial benefit of the TIF district works so you kind of understand the financial impact to the village. Once the TIF district was created, all the existing properties within the TIF boundaries had an existing value at the time the district was created. All the taxing jurisdictions, the village, the county, the school district, all continue to collect their share of taxes on that property that's within the district based on the base value of at the time it was created. So there's no change in terms of the tax distribution on the tax base that was present at the time the TID was created. The benefit to the village over the long term is as new development occurs within that district, either new development or appreciation of the property value beyond the value of a property when it was first created, all of that new value gets taxed, and the village gets to retain its share of the taxes and all the other taxing jurisdictions' share of the taxes on that new development. So, the example that we use here in our report, if you had a property that had a base value of $500,000 when the TID was created, and you had new value that increased the total value to $750,000, the village would keep all the tax revenues generated on that $250,000 of additional development. And that's really where the financial benefit is to the village. It's a partnership with all the other taxing jurisdictions that they're pledging to provide their tax revenue on new development for the village to pay for expenses within that district to help promote development. And so it's a long-term partnership between the village to help foster its economic goals. In terms of those properties that are within the TID district, there's no difference in the tax rate that they pay. Whether you're in the TID district or outside the TID district, everyone pays the same tax rate. The only difference is how that tax revenue is collected and how it is distributed. Alloway's TID district was established as a rehabilitation TID district. So at the time the TID was created, it was determined that at least 50% of the area within the district met the statutory criteria of an area in need of rehabilitation or reinvestment. And so that permits the village to keep the TID district open for a maximum of 27 years. You're not obligated to keep the TID district open that long. The TID district closes either once it reaches its maximum life and all the project costs are expended, or as the village moves forward with project costs and if revenues generated in the village has generated enough financial funds within the TID district to pay all of your outstanding costs or obligations, you can close the TID early. So that's the maximum period that you have is 27 years, but you can certainly close prior to that. When the TID was created, the main document that was generated is called a project plan, which the village has a copy of that on file. But within that document, it identified certain project costs that the village had anticipated that it would incur over the life of the district. And those are summarized on the last page of the handout after the map of the TID district. These primarily consisted of infrastructure projects located within three development areas within the boundaries of the district that were established. And the village has flexibility within the project plan on how to pursue particular projects. The projects that were identified in the plan were the village's best estimation at that time of what project costs would occur, but the village has flexibility to spend the money on infrastructure and other public improvements or in development incentives within the district as development opportunities dictate. So your obligations anytime you consider going forward with the funding TID projects is to look at the actual new value that's been generated in the district and determine if those funds and that development will be sufficient to generate enough tax revenue to cover the costs. So up to this point, since the district was created, the initial steps that the village took after that fact were to create some policies and procedures that they put in place. The village wanted to have a criteria and procedure put in place if people requested development incentives. So that work was done with input from the Plan Commission, the Village Board, and a policy and procedure was created that the village will use to consider those requests. Also, there was a policy and procedure developed for facade rehabilitation program for any businesses that may want to seek grants or loans to improve the exterior of their business. That particular program would require funding from the village to get it off the ground. So there were those initial steps taken after the TID district was created. Ultimately, over the life of the district, it's the village's opportunity to use the Tax Increment Finance District to promote economic development and redevelopment within the district boundaries that help accomplish your overall land use goals and development objectives. So it's really a long-range tool that the village can use to integrate with its long-range land use and master planning to try to provide some financial backing to achieve the type of development and land use that you would like to see within that particular district. It's ultimately the responsibility of the village board to determine what projects are funded within the TID district. They do have to be eligible TID expenditures and identified within your project plan. But all of the project costs that were identified within your plan, you know, still require approval from the village board as you go forward and the district goes through its maximum life period. So even though projects and initial costs are identified in the plan, you're not committed to any of those projects. You still have the opportunity to review them as circumstances warrant and make some particular adjustments. So there's really no immediate changes that this implemented to the village's zoning or land use, but you certainly have the opportunity to make those adjustments to try to foster the type of development that you want to see over the life of the district. So to summarize, and I'll be happy to answer any particular questions, the TIF district is really a tool that the village can use to promote economic development and redevelopment within its value. And within its boundaries. The benefit to the village from a financial standpoint is that any tax revenue that's collected on new development or appreciation of property within the boundaries of the district, the village gets to keep its share and all the other taxing jurisdictions' share of that property tax revenue to help pay for project expenditures within the district. And so that's really the financial benefit to the village in terms of getting that tax revenue to help pay for those expenditures. So I know you have a full agenda. I can go on, but I want to respect your time and let you pause if you have any questions.
Yeah, let me just back up. The reason that we asked you to come tonight is really because we have three new village board members who may not know a lot about the TID and how it works, and we have some people in the community who probably don't know. I bet you didn't know that much about TID this TID district, did you? There's going to be a quiz pretty soon, so I hope you're paying attention. The TID's been around for a little while now. When did we officially launch?
2012.
So it's been a couple of years, and we are sort of readdressing the issue, and as a new administrator comes in, this will be a focus of his or her responsibility. So we thought it would be a good time just to have you come back and summarize. Are there any questions? Yes, Trustee Rafferty.
How long do we get to keep the additional tax revenue?
Up to potentially 27 years, the maximum life of the district. So if that's the statutory maximum for the type of district that Alloway created. If you generate enough revenue within the tax increment district that it's sufficient to pay for all of your anticipated project costs and expenditures, you can close the district early. You're required to do so under statute. But 27 years is the maximum period.
Thanks.
Have we generated any income from this as of yet?
No. The first eligible year you were able to collect increment was this year. Since the district had a base value as of January 1st of 2012, there was some modest depreciation of all the property within the district, so there hasn't been any increment collected yet. I mean, generally, your main increment's going to come from actual new construction and new development. That's really where you see the financial benefit.
And we do have a couple of different programs, and one is a facade program for a smaller type, which you wouldn't expect to generate. I mean, that doesn't add to the generation of new value. It's the brand new development that takes place. But hopefully we'll pretty soon be down that road as well. Trustee Doyle?
After my commission meeting last night, an idea sprung up about if TID funds could be used to help with the revisions of the zoning code.
Yes, I think you would want to identify part of that could be a TID eligible expenditure. There's certain administrative and planning costs that you can charge to a TID district. assuming if that encompasses areas outside of the district, you would want to determine, you know, how much of the total cost that you're investing is really related to property within the TID district, you know, because properties outside the district wouldn't be eligible for that cost.
Any other questions?
The map that we have, that's the sum total distance from point to point for the TID district?
Yes.
Is it possible at some point to have an additional one, or does one have to close in order for a little over?
No, you can have more than one TID district open, but there are certain tests that are identified in the statutes in order for that to occur. The maximum amount of value that you can have within a TID district, so you have an existing TID, you would have to take the increment value within that district and then the base value of any new district, add those two numbers together, that cannot exceed 12% of the entire equalized value of the property within the village. So the answer is yes, but to a limit, as long as you don't have too much value within the district.
And that's 12%.
12% of equalized value of all property within the village. So if you were looking to create another district, just for illustration purposes, you would take the increment value of TID 1 at the time you're creating a new district, the base value of all property within the proposed second district, and then that sum of those two numbers can exceed 12% of the equalized value of the community.
That's at the current time of application for the second district?
Yes.
So if you're going to do more than one TID district, it behooves you to do them kind of right in a row, because you haven't realized any increment in the first. Is that?
Yes, I think it's something that can certainly be done and just kind of monitored as you go forward to see how close you're getting to that 12% test. That's, you know, we did that test when we created the new district, and then if you were looking at creating a second district, we would see how close you were getting to that 12% limit, so you don't, you know, how much value you can add in a new district before you're tipped out, so to speak.
Right. Any other? Trustee Rafter.
One last question. What value is a TID to potential businesses coming in?
The value of the TID to potential businesses can be, there's several examples. If there is some particular infrastructure, public infrastructure, streets, stormwater, water, sewer, or some other type of infrastructure that's needed to facilitate that particular development or improve existing infrastructure that's already in place, you know, and that new development or new business is going to generate some new value, that tax revenue you generate on that new value could be used to offset the cost of that infrastructure cost. You can also use the money to provide, you know, a development incentive or a grant to help offset some of the costs of that business may be incurring to come in to the village, and that gets back to the policy that the village adopted to kind of specify the criteria and the analysis that would be done to determine if an incentive was appropriate. You're not obligated to provide incentives, but the TID does give you the flexibility to do that if you determine the circumstances are appropriate.
Great, thank you.
We've restricted incentives to external parts of the building. If that was a village decision, if I remember correctly, right?
Right. And yeah, in your incentive policy, you had specific criteria that you would use to apply particular incentives, and also just some general analysis of the proposed development and the particular financing of that particular development to determine if TIF assistance was really needed to kind of provide financial assistance for that project to occur. So there's criteria and analysis that's identified in your policy to specify how you would evaluate that. So it's not something that's you know, done you know, without some specific policy and criteria to back it up.
And as we move forward with the old Village Hall property, you know, there'll be developers who are interested in the TID, because the old Village Hall is in the TID, and there are some restrictions as to what you can ask for in terms of an incentive and furniture and internal elements aren't part of possible TID funding.
But my understanding is that can change at the pleasure of the village board.
Yes. Absolutely.
I mean, if we wanted to grant a developer X number of dollars to offset or mitigate the cost of construction of the facility, we can do that.
Yes.
We have to go through a board act.
Correct. You evaluate all things as they come forward. So you have a policy to kind of outline certain parameters, but certainly at your discretion to make adjustments as you see fit.
Thank you. Are the funds from the specific districts in District 1 and 2, do they have stay within that specific District 1? In other words, can District 1 help District 2 if there's something that they need a large to get over?
Yeah, the village has one district at this point in time. So there's
if there were two.
If there were two, there are certain statutory criteria that has to be met to donate increment from one district to another. So that possibility does exist as long as a certain criteria can be satisfied.
Anything further? Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Appreciate
you
coming
you.
Back. We're slow learners. So. Okay, a presentation by Girl Scout Troop 4480 of the Green Island Park Flower Garden and Sign Project. Sorry to make you wait through that.
If I could just give a little overview.
Yeah.
I was contacted by the Girl Scouts for a potential project, as we have been for many years for Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. Some of the projects have been birdhouses to remapping a park, just a lot of different things. And this project was a little more of an interest, thanks to Jim O'Rourke. And thank Jim for that. Jim brought to me the idea of doing bent trees or trail marker trees, which were used many, many years ago. And so that was a project that I presented to Troop 4480. And they're here tonight to show what they've done.
All right.
Well, I'm going to let the girls introduce themselves.
Great. Thank you. Come up and take a...
So...
Can you give us your name, please?
I'm Brianna.
And
Hannah.
Hannah.
And Kate.
Kate?
She's Kate.
Kay and Caitlin?
She's Caitlin, I'm Emily.
Okay. All right.
Your sister.
All right.
When we first started, Brad only bent one of the trees a year before.
Okay.
And we spent a few weeks planning the design and getting it approved with Brad. This is basically what it looked like before all the trees are bent and fire beds put in. That's the outline of basic beds. So the dirt would be put instead of grass.
Okay.
Greg got the volunteers to get the grass out. We didn't do any of that.
What? Smart.
Management in terms of the future.
We asked plant donations from Schrader's. We received 400 plants, which was twice as many as we needed.
Wow.
So we had to make them fit.
Not a bad problem to have, though.
We stuck extra plants in next to the fences that we also built. And also put the mulch in, hopefully prevent weeds. Is it working? It's not working.
Oh, no.
We also bent a secondary tree and decorated it with beads and leather. And then the final step was to create the sign and mount it on the rock shelf.
How long did it take you to do it from start to finish?
Up 2 years.
About 2 years from start to finish?
Including planning.
Okay. And what about the actual work, the construction work? A year?
Yeah. About half a year to get the sign in.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, we couldn't find a place to get the sign.
Oh, no. Okay.
If you haven't seen it, it's at Green Isle, and as you cross over the footbridge,
yeah.
It's a nice entryway into the park. The girls did a wonderful job with minimal help and supervision. But it really turned out to be more than what I really anticipated. I worked hand in hand with the girls. I let them kind of run with something, and then they would bring it back. And the donations they received was phenomenal.
We brought Dennis Downs, thanks to Jim O'Rourke, we're two minutes in. Dennis Downs is an author and artist who is published and travels around the world talking about bent trees. And that's what we wanted to create in Green Isle, because there's not many left. There was a trail from Green Bay to Chicago. And this is kind of a little bit in the area. So we bent one tree to give you directions to Heritage Hill, and one tree is bent to continue down the river, and then the third one will be bent towards East High School because that's part of the trail system.
Cool.
That's
aerial view from satellite.
Wow.
From
the
church?
It's from our boom truck.
Oh. Alloy satellite.
Brett just likes to call it a
satellite. I took the picture.
Yeah. From her. From an astronaut.
And we have daffodils and tulips in there that just finished.
It's really nice.
On behalf of Girl Scout Troop 4480, I would like to thank the Village of Alloway, Brad, and Jim.
Excellent. Can we ask a few questions? Are you finished? I didn't want to interrupt. Okay.
Go ahead.
What made you decide on this project?
We had a silverware to do, and we had no clue what to do.
What was the process for the,
Just
a lot of drawing, okay.
Didn't know what to do, decided to visit Alloway, see what they wanted or needed help with, and talked to Brad, see what he wanted.
Excellent. Any other questions?
Was it harder than you thought?
No. Nope.
Working with Brad, or?
No.
Brad was the easiest part.
Is there some notation there for your troop 4480 so that the people in the future time will know?
Yeah.
I'm signing different credits to Alloway and trails and trips that the way I am is thanking all the donations and people who assisted. And your names are on there? Mm-hmm. Well, in your record. Troop 4480. What does this sign say? My eyes are bent. I can't read it. Look at Brad.
These trees were America's first road signs. They were bent as young saplings by Native Americans to guide them to a place, to places of significance. Today, the trees are rapidly disappearing from the landscape, and we're enjoying, and we're trying to honor and preserve the memory.
Well, that's nice. Who came up with the words for the song?
Very nice.
So now when these trees grow, they grow bent like that? They have just
They keep growing bigger, but then they shoot up. It's kind of hard to explain. Kind of like a big bent nail of a tree.
This author, Dennis Downs, that I mentioned earlier, when he was up, took a picture, the girls came out, we took a picture, and they were here that day, right?
Yeah.
Or Jim was, but it's in one of his books that he has published. Kind of nice little
signature
for us.
Nice job, girls.
Mm-hmm. Are these your parents, or troop leaders, or both? Or?
Troop leaders.
A little bit of both. Okay.
One of the troop leaders and then the parents.
Okay. We have our co-leader here, but not the actual troop leader.
Okay.
Leader is her mom.
Okay. Great. Any other questions or comments? That's really good stuff. Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, a presentation on developing neighborhood associations by Cheryl Rainier Wig from Green Bay.
Sure, I have to follow the Girl Scouts. All right, I'm going to talk to you today about neighborhood associations in the city of Green Bay. just a brief discussion about them, and then you can ask any questions you might have with regards to how we do it in Green Bay. First of all, what is a neighborhood association? Well, it's not Neighborhood Watch. That is a separate entity set up for crime prevention purposes routinely, and it's a smaller geographic area. Neighborhood associations are larger areas. Our associations range from 200 people to 1,000 people, so it's kind of a larger area with basically common goals. The neighborhood has a common goal. In Astor, it's to preserve the historic nature of the neighborhood. In Starlight, it's to have, you know, a community, neighborhood types of events. So it's really dependent on each neighborhood association on why they form. And the purpose is really why we started them in Green Bay is, I mean, I've been with the city for a long time, so I remember the time when we had city projects that we really did not get neighborhood input on. And when Paul Jaden took office, he said, you know, we really need to flip this over. We need to do this grassroots up. So that's when we started in the mid-90s was forming neighborhood associations because we wanted input from the citizens when we were doing these public projects. So now, for example, in the city of Green Bay, when we have a development project that comes forward or a street reconstruction, that goes to the neighborhood association first for input. And with an example of some place like East Shore Drive, when that drive was redone, that original plan had no bike lanes and minimal lighting. And that association is like, well, wait a minute here. We need to get some bike lanes. A lot of people bike out here. So that street has changed as a result of input from that neighborhood association. So neighborhood associations do a whole lot of different things. And it's all dependent on who's running the boards. You know, some are very active. Some are doing 10 events a year. Some really just meet, maybe quarterly. Most of them are set up as boards. They elect boards every year. And they choose how often they meet. They're not an arm of the city. They are separate entities. Some of them are 501c3s. Some of them are not. So their level of achievement is based on, you know, who sits on their board and how active they are. In the city of Green Bay, when we started forming them, we really wanted to make sure that the process was uniform in order for a neighborhood association to get recognized. So in order to become a recognized neighborhood association in the city of Green Bay, you have to go through a process of forming, which includes you need to have clearly defined geographical areas that are inclusive. So none of this, I don't like Bob, so he's out. You know, it's got to be the whole area inclusive. You need to have a name. You need to have a mission statement and a purpose for your neighborhood association. You have to elect a board of directors. And in order to form this, as mentioned, you'll see there's a process we go through. I'm actually forming an association right now in King of Arms in the far west side of Green Bay. So I go in, I meet with a small group of people, I explain the process. Hey, you want to go forward or not? It's up to you because they're driving this process. They say yay. We have a second meeting. We'll publish that probably in the Press Gazette. Scott's still here? I'm just going to kill two birds with one stone. We publish it in the Press Gazette. And then people come, and then we work on the things that need to be voted on. So when we come to the third meeting, that's the big annual meeting. People vote on a name, they vote on a mission statement, boundaries, they vote on all those things. Once they do that, they're a recognized neighborhood association. They go to city council, they get a plaque, they get on the official list for the city. So they get notified then when things happen with regards to the city projects. Neighborhood associations are funded in the city of Green Bay privately. There is, with the exception of my staff time, which is pretty limited with neighborhood associations, there's no city money that goes into neighborhood associations. We have something, which is actually a pretty cool model. I'd love to see somebody duplicate it. We have something called the Green Bay Neighborhood Leadership Council. It's a separate, nonprofit 501c3. We do a capital campaign about every 3 or 4 years. We're in the process right now of raising $500,000. We've raised over $1 million in the past 3 campaigns. That money then is channeled directly to neighborhood associations. Does not go through like city council or committees per se. It's run through the Green Bay Neighborhood Leadership Council. So we're able to do things kind of in a non-political way. We don't have to worry about, well, this district's doing this and this district, you know. It's really run through the separate entity, through the Leadership Council. Associations, when they're formed, they get $1,000 to start with. And then they also can apply for mini grants from this association. And those can range from $2,000 to $5,000. You might have seen some things around Green Bay that we do routinely. Neighborhood signs. If everyone knows the Starlight sign, that's by Happy Joe's, across from Happy Joe's. That's a neighborhood association sign. They, of course, that's our model sign. Of course, they plant that up typically, but every association gets one of those neighborhood signs, so they're all over the city. And then, they, of course, they get the support from us with regards to helping them run their meetings or, you know, apply for these mini grants, pick projects. We have an activity arsenal that we supply to neighborhoods. So if they want to do outdoor movies, we have the equipment for that. We have tents, we have chairs, we have bingo, we have games for kids, we have all these things. So that's kind of neighborhood associations in a nutshell. Gave you a map. We have 39 right now. The goal is, of course, to form the whole city. I'm working on 40. That's my pitch to them. You want to be 40. That's a big number. So that being said, do you have any questions for me that I can answer about associations?
Trustee Guest?
Well, thank you very much for the presentation. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something that would benefit Alloway greatly. In terms of establishing the geographical boundaries, I mean, is that kind of a historical approach by subdivision? I mean, what's kind of the consensus, or how do you arrive at the boundaries?
When we first started, we formed the downtown neighborhoods first. And some of them were clear. You know, Fort Howard, Seymour, Tank, they were kind of close to parks. So they kind of were their own neighborhoods. What we look at, like, for example, we're forming the far west side now, King of Arms, out here. And there's nothing in this white section right now. So I'm bringing a map of this whole area to this meeting where we're going to plan out the boundaries. And I'm going to say, okay, what are your geographical boundaries? Well, all our kids go to this school. We never really cross the street here. You know, and then we kind of form that boundary. I mean, we want it to be connected to other associations, you know, if they're that close. Rivers are boundaries, main streets are boundaries. So, you know, we kind of work with them to kind of define those geographic boundaries.
Thank you.
You said you had a model that you were working from. Is that something that you have written form and script that you could pass along for us to take a look at and review and be able to share?
This is actually what we use for our capital campaign right now, but it really talks about the timeline for the Leadership Council, and, you know, our funding source, how we work this, what we've done. I can leave this with you. You know, there's also a card here for anyone who might be interested in making a donation. I'll leave that too. I have to do that. I'm on the committee. So I can leave this with you. You certainly can take a look at this. This kind of talks about how this model is run. It's kind of a nice way because it puts some ownership on the associations themselves to raise money as well. You know, because otherwise I think our associations, if they were to become dependent on the city for dollars, then, I don't know, it's kind of a different animal then. So this way they have, you know, to get that $1,000 a year, they have to raise $250 to get that. They have to publish a newsletter annually. So there's some things that they have to do in order to, you know, get the money from the Leadership Council. So there are pluses with it that way.
Are the neighborhood associations linked in any way with the Green Bay website? I know you're not affiliated with the city itself. But
we do. Then actually, because I do run the neighborhood division, so as part of the neighborhood division, we do have a website. We're working on that right now. The goal is to get the city laid out, so you can just click on the association and it pulls the information up. But so they are linked. I mean, we have connections with the associations. We have the contact list, so people call us and say, hey, what neighborhood am I in? I can forward that information to them. So we are connected that way.
And do you have somebody that's from within the association who has walked the trail before us, who would be available as a resource person or a mentor for our group in the event that we decide to do something like that?
That would probably be me. I've been doing it. I probably formed most of them. I've been the president of the neighborhood association, so I certainly, if anyone's interested in forming, I could maybe walk them through a process. I'd be more than happy to do that. Mm-hmm. I'll give you my home phone number.
It's really interesting. I didn't really know about the original intent of neighborhood associations. Mm-hmm. It's exactly the kind of thing that we're talking about, of being able to communicate to residents on a variety of issues, but some of the issues that have come up, you know, a few months ago involve public works projects, and we just had a hard time getting the word out. And, you know, we're struggling with how big does the project have to be before you notify, and then do you notify every house? And so this would be a really nice vehicle for notification of residents on a variety of issues, but it's interesting that it started out because of projects.
Yep, really. And you might have noticed Monroe is closed. I mean, so there was a number of meetings with regards to the closure of Monroe and how we're going to facilitate, you know, the businesses and the neighborhoods and, you know, how's that all going to work, so.
Thank you.
How many of the neighborhood associations, how many have neighborhood watches as well, or part of them, or?
Probably most of them, because okay. I think the city has, I'm not sure, I think it's over 100 watches. They're scattered throughout the city. And, you know, sometimes it's an active neighborhood watch that actually forms a neighborhood association. So we've had a number of those where there was an active watch, and then they're like, hey, we want to get bigger. So they actually became more than just the watch. One of the goals we have as the city is for each association to have a number of watches that cover their boundaries, and then they connect together and they attend that board meeting, and then they talk about crime preventions and agenda on that board meeting. Okay. So, and then they're somehow, you know, they're connected then through this web, through the city. But crime prevention actually forms our watches through the police department in the city of Green Bay.
Okay.
Yep, and I'm going through the planning department with where we're looking.
Anything further?
Thanks so much for coming.
I appreciate
it. Here's my
thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Okay, I have a couple of announcements before I'll open it up. The Brown County Solid Waste Board, Troy Strickenbach asked me to sit on that board, and I simply can't do it. I'm not sure if he's found someone, but I wanted to announce to all of you that they were looking for, last time I talked to them, they were looking for someone. It's a pretty important board to have representation on. So if you're at all interested, let me know, and I'll see if they're still looking for someone and if we can fill that with someone. Secondly, the Brown County Planning Commission meets tomorrow night. One of the items on the agenda is the construction of the committee itself. I serve on that committee, and I can't make it tomorrow. So if anyone is available tomorrow evening and has the time or inclination to sit in as an extra set of ears at that meeting, that would be very, very helpful. Any other announcements, either to the board or to the public in general? Brad, please.
This Saturday and Sunday is the National Trails Day, so Brown County's opening up their trails free to people to use. So it's both Saturday and Sunday.
Thank you. Clara?
And then we just want to announce that the village is implementing summer hours. We're going to do that from May 2nd through Labor Day. So Village Hall will be open Monday through Thursday, 7 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Just to allow greater flexibility for residents and employees. We're doing a test basis this summer for the first time, and we'll track utilization of those hours between 7:30 and 4:30, so as mentioned, all who's using that. On Fridays, I normal.
Okay. Can you repeat the hours again? Monday through Thursday?
Monday through Thursday, 7 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Fridays, 7:30 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Okay. Thank you. Any other announcements? Okay, hearing none, we'll move on to public appearances. Is there anyone who'd like to speak this evening? Yes, sir.
I'm Jim O'Rourke, 2339 Oakwood Avenue. I belong to a variety of historical groups. Recently, the Historic Preservation Committee has been meeting often and way too frequently in closed session for no particular reason other than to conceal the bid opening on a competitive bid from the public. I was very concerned with that. I participated in the original contractor selection a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and for the bidding on the National Register nomination for the Village of Oakwood properties, the two water department buildings, there was a solicitation sent out to a short list of five people. Three people responded. One, the most qualified bidder, was the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. They have 19 years' experience in it, and they were clearly the most qualified bidder in the group. There was a private sector that was the lowest bidder, but the bid was actually awarded to somebody else. And the bid opening was not done in public. I had to file a open documents request in order to even get the bids, and I still haven't seen the evaluation forms. So before you approve the bid tonight, I would ask the board to have a review of the different bids and the different contractors that were involved there. And again, it doesn't get any better than the University of Wisconsin. That's part of what's called the Wisconsin Idea. It's partnership between the university and the communities out there and sharing knowledge. And the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, is probably one of the best contractors the State Historical Society has on their list, and they were rejected. And they weren't the high bid. They were the middle bid. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak? Yes, sir.
May I come up with a couple of charts?
Sure.
It's not a presentation. I just want to demonstrate.
Sure.
That's good. Can I use that easel?
Absolutely.
Good evening. My name is Mike Moore. I live at 580 Hilltop Drive, which is perpendicular to the old Hilltop Apartments. I'm here tonight to express the Neighborhood Association's feelings, even though it's not a formal association. We have at least 88 people that are interested in what's going on these two streets, Hilltop and Somerset. About a year ago, we presented the town board a petition asking for consideration of a park. However, that did not gain any traction. So the redevelopment went forward. Now we're at the point tonight where the town board has to make a decision on what exactly is going to be built at that location. Okay? We don't have a problem with the feasibility of it or the economic or the qualifications of Hillcrest Lumber, but we do have a question about the impact it's going to have on the surrounding property values. And that's really never been discussed. I've come before the Planning Commission, talked to Penny, several times, and to no avail. What we have seen is one proposal from Hillcrest Lumber, and that's before you tonight. What we as a neighborhood association and property owners would like an opportunity to see other alternatives as far as building on that particular property, which we have not seen. This is a new Walgreens being built, soon open on the east side of DePere. The other picture on the right hand is an existing Walgreens on the west side of DePere. Now, the west side of DePere is a standard format for Walgreens that are using all over the country. However, to conform to the wishes of the community and the Common Council, Walgreens decided to alter their national facade, if you want to use that word, and come in with a building that's more in tune to the neighborhood. As you can see, it's brick, it's staggered. It's quite a nice building if you ever want to drive by it or shop there. It's going to open in a couple of weeks. It's well landscaped, well lit. not asking Hillcrest Lumber to spend any more. Oops. What I am asking for is be more innovative in the use of the brick exterior for aesthetic reasons. We can use different colors, different patterns, but to have one mass of the same color brick almost two blocks long with no shutters. That one time I heard looks like a barracks or an airplane hangar. Really doesn't behoove Alloway in the long run. That's all I have to say tonight.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Is there anyone else who'd like to speak this evening? Yes, ma'am.
And I live at 337 Taft. I have never come to any of these, so it's still new to me. But I spoke with my neighbors yesterday and just found out that a sex offender had moved across the street from me. And I was just wondering what is being done. And I know we're discussing it tonight with the ordinances and just the comfortability of a neighborhood. And I know we were talking about a neighborhood association before, but just what changes are going to be made to Alloway with a sex offender moving in, being a single individual, who's a homeowner, paying taxes, and then also the community having a lot of young single women that do live in that area and a lot of young families, what that's going to do to the community. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Evening. I'm John Schimmen. I live at 543 Hilltop. Going back to what Mike was talking about, the apartments at the foot of Hilltop Way, I was here several weeks ago when the Planning Commission met, and there was a big discussion about the plan at that time. I understand it's been changed, but I had raised the topic at that time about traffic, and in particular, the way parking is on Hilltop Way, which I think leads to excessive traffic coming down Hilltop and possibly Somerset. I don't know if there's any Somerset people here or not. But I remember being told by the Planning Commission they didn't have anything to say about parking or speed limits or that type of thing. So now that the plan, I believe, from what I understand, is being going to be voted on by the board tonight, I'd like to raise the topic again about thinking about parking restrictions on Hilltop Way. The way the old apartments were, there was parking, I believe there were underground garages for a while, and certainly there were parking in the back, the east side of the building. But practically every day, both sides of Hilltop Way were parked full with the various residents. And what that amounts to is people that work in De Pere or even in Alloway, when they wanted to go home for lunch or even in the evenings, instead of going around Hoffman Road and coming in on East River Drive into their own parking lot, so to speak, depending on where their apartment was specifically in that building, they could come down Hilltop Drive and just swing around the corner and park right in front of their door and then walk into their own apartment. If the parking was restricted to perhaps just a few handicapped, maybe a few other spots, I think it would cut down a lot on the traffic on Hilltop Drive. And Mike talked about the homeowners. A lot of us have talked to each other. I'm not sure how many are here tonight. But it's the traffic that is my main concern. Mike, living next door, obviously has a lot more concerns than I do living up in the 500 numbers. But if the parking could be considered, I think it might do a lot to alleviate some of the traffic that is certain to get a lot bigger once that new apartment building is built. So that's what I had to say.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak this evening? Yes, sir.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Darren Adkins, committee candidate. Something came up with the TIFT, and me being a first-time attendee, I thought I would raise a voice erring on the side of caution. Everybody was really excited about how to spend any additional revenues that came in from that, but we've all been through a housing bubble recently. One has to have an err on the side of caution. What if Alloway actually funds a development project similar to on the corner of East River and Hoffman? Many of those buildings on the frontage there remained empty for quite some time. And I'm just wondering, rather than recognising income from any increase in property values, is it like a profit and loss with a business, where if you actually pay for a building that then maybe the business fails and it's sat there, can you write that off, or how does that affect the village's finances?
Is he gone now?
I didn't know the protocol, but
there is risk involved. There is a risk that you would fund things through a TIF that don't succeed, and then you're sort of out that investment.
Because I was just wondering, he said about the 27 years that you can pay off, if you can use that money, but do you have the same kind of leeway if you have like a write-off type of situation?
I'm not sure about the write-off situation, but you do have 27 years to make a go of it. Okay. So you are taking a risk.
You didn't open it to the floor, and I didn't know whether somebody should raise that caution, you know. So just mention it. Thank you.
And you should know the TIF is in place, but I think what you're cautioning is the types of projects that are funded to make sure that they're projects that have a higher likelihood of succeeding. That's what the criteria are supposed to be set up for deciding on what gets funded. Thank you for that. Anyone else who'd like to speak? I'm going to open it up when we get to your application as well. So all right, hearing none, we will move on to item 6, action regarding the site plan review for the Village View Apartments, 3415 Hilltop Way. This is from the Planning Commission and from April, and the Village Board from May. Before I entertain a motion, or does someone have a motion right now? I was going to ask Trevor to give us a bit of a summary. Trevor, can you sort of describe the process that's taken place so far, and including the PDD process that we thought we were going down, and then sort of where we stand right now, and in terms of what the Hillcrest Lumber had to do and what they didn't have to do in getting to this point?
Sure. Everyone knows that the Hilltop Apartments burned down about a year ago. That complex was quite a bit bigger. They have since come forward to the village to redevelop the property. They first came in December, I believe, through the PDD process, which allows a lot more flexibility on both ends, either the village and the developer, as to what actually gets put on the property. But being that it was already zoned for high density use, Focus decided to go through site plan review. They came through the Planning Commission in April. Site plan review, we have the set requirements laid out in the zoning codes and building codes, and as long as it fits within that district and the developer follows those codes, it is recommended by the village. It did go to Planning Commission for initial review in April, and Planning Commission raised a few concerns. I addressed those in the memo that you guys all received. Those conditions have all been met, as well as the conditions laid out by village staff. By focus. The three main ones that kind of took some time addressing were the turnaround, or the drive access to Hilltop Way. That has since been eliminated, and the turnaround configuration in the parking lot has been replaced it. Another issue was the garage is on the south end of the property. They were underneath some low-hanging power lines, and they have been moved to the west end of the property and have obtained proper approval by ATC, the power company. And then the third one was, as a result of those two changes, the stormwater management had to be changed a few times to accommodate those different changes. I'll let Dan Doro.
Okay, before we go to that, can you summarize real quickly the difference in, you mentioned that the PDD process is different from the site plan review process. With regard to aesthetics and some of the things that were being mentioned by the residents in that area, which of those processes allows for more discretion than dictation of aesthetics?
The plan development district is more open to village input. The site plan review, as long as there are certain sightings and other requirements laid out in the zoning codes that the village allows, and as long as the developer follows those requirements, then the village really has no say.
Okay, and then in terms of the reason that it's on the village board agenda this evening, and it took a little while to get it here, and there was some frustration, is we wanted to make sure that everything was buttoned up in terms of the requirement for site plan review, the stormwater plan, the power line issue, and that's why we're talking about it now. That's all been put in place and is ready to go.
That's great.
Thank you. Anyone else from the village staff that would like to summarize before we hear from the petitioner? Okay. Yes, please, sir.
Hi, I think you all know me, but I'm Dan Doro, construction supervisor for Hillcrest Homes. They keep getting moved up in the batting order. I do appreciate that. Thank you. We're here to present, obviously, the Village View Apartments. And, there's been a few different steps and hoops that we've tried to jump through. Part of it, as far as when Mr. Moore is talking about the original, where it looked like a separate barracks, the building has been staggered. We've staggered the garage. We obviously feel it's a very nice looking apartment. I do have, it's going to be all brick. I have brick samples. It'll be dimensional roofing, white windows. The ask about heavy grade siding, we do have they want at least an 042 siding. This is a 044 siding, so it's a little heavier siding for the garage. When they're talking about some of the different options of what could be done with the apartment, we feel we have an upgraded apartment. We have an elevator in it. It's got laundries in each apartment. To start, at one time it was asked about, well, separating the apartments. Well, now you're going to be losing your elevator. You can't just be putting elevators. It's just not economical feasible to put elevators in small apartments. So we'd be losing our elevator. Some of the other issues that got brought up as far as the traffic. We did eliminate sidewalks that were going out. We had to leave one going out to Hilltop, but the sidewalks we eliminated going out to Hilltop to kind of keep the traffic going that way from going that way. Originally, they wanted the driveway going around. That was kind of a request from the village for the fire department to get the driveway to go out continuous to come out onto Hilltop. And then when the neighbors really didn't like that, they asked us to change it, so we changed it back to where we had to meet the fire truck turnaround so the traffic won't go out on the Hilltop. I think we've cooperated, on obviously all of the stuff that has been brought up to this point. As far as roof lines and stuff, and I know some of that doesn't show real good on the pictures, there's staggered hip lines there where the balconies are. And again, the building, the middle part is staggered from the rest of it. It's going to be professionally landscaped. I guess that's really all I have to say. I don't know if you have any questions on it.
Is the middle part, when you say it's staggered, I can't see it. Is it recessed or does
yeah.
it come out?
Yes, if you look at if you look like at the site plan, the center part, the center building is actually set to the east of what the other two buildings are. So they're not, it's not all just one line, it's set back, and it's, I don't know off the top of my head, 6 or 8 feet, so it's a, they're staggered. One building's forward, one's back, one's forward. Of the three, they're not all just in one straight line. But we did the same thing with the garages. The garages on the east side, rather than having them all in one line, we staggered the center section of garages back kind of to follow the pattern with the building. So it's stepped back. We put brick on the front, the brick pillars on the front of the garage, bricks on the end of the garage, the heavier gauge siding on the back, plus there's brick every 24 feet across the back side of the east side of the garage. You see where I'm saying with the word staggered? So, and I know it doesn't show that good on the rendering, but it's not all just one straight barracks, I guess.
Any questions? Trustee Dart?
I looked at these drawings many times, and I don't know if they've changed where you put the dumpster. I know that it's been changed, and I didn't quite find it.
Yes, there was a couple different changes along the line that was brought up as far as like snow removal and things like that. The dumpsters, actually, the dumpster is going to be at the end of the garage, kind of like we did across the street where we're putting the siding on the walls to match the garage. So that the dumpster is number 11, I believe, which would be on the south end of the easterly garages. That's that pad where, if you're looking at the site plan, number 3 shows the concrete pad, then number 11 shows the dumpster pad. You see where it is? It's on the. Do you have a site plan? I have a big.
Dumpster will be right here.
Okay.
Just to the south of the garage.
So this is Bob Mock. He did the engineering for this.
Yes.
Okay.
They'll access here and they'll utilize the turnaround area for the emergency vehicles to access the dumpster pads. The concrete pad for the dumpsters as well as the front terrible area.
And it'll be a nice, dense concrete so it doesn't crack.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're not building up on the asphalt and
yep.
Turning motions there.
Thanks, Bob. There was different issues were brought up that Trevor was talking about as far as lighting requirements. They wanted minimum lighting. There was a question of interpretation of what the average lighting, what you needed for lighting, and we've upgraded all the lighting to more than exceed what the minimum foot candle power is. We went to some taller ones to get more lighting, but in you have the lighting layout. I don't know if you all got a chance to see that or not, but they've exceeded all of the minimum foot candles in all of the areas.
Anything further?
Not if there's no
okay.
questions.
Any questions?
Yep, I do. Is that the front of the building facing the residence, or is that the back of the building?
That's the front. That would be on Hilltop. That's the sign in the far corner. That's on the front of the building. That's not okay. The parking lot you're looking at.
Okay. The west sign. Side of the building. So
okay.
That would be facing the residence on Hilltop and Somerset.
So there's not a main entrance to the building? Or
there's a sidewalk to the entrance. We took the sidewalks. There was originally sidewalks, you know, from the apartments going out to Hilltop and to keep the, so people weren't in there. You know, there was a question about parking, which I don't think has anything to do with us as far as where they can park or whatever. That's up to planning, but to keep the people from trying to filter out to Hilltop, to scale to the back, to the parking lot where they're going to be parking mainly. I don't know what's going on with the parking on Hilltop. Again, we have anything to do with that, but to try to keep them to the parking lot rather than coming out to Hilltop, the sidewalks were taken out. They did want still one main entrance going into the building. There is not, originally at one time they talked about doing handicap parking, and then they recommended we don't do that. So we don't want people parking out there. We want them using the back entrances. So we took all of the sidewalks out to hopefully alleviate that problem.
Did you have sidewalks to each door? I don't remember.
Originally, I think there were sidewalks to each door coming from Hilltop. Yes, there was a bunch of sidewalks. I think it was to each door, and those all got removed.
I'm just curious, like, why would we take out the sidewalk that would go straight across the front? Because wouldn't it be nice to have a sidewalk there?
Well, but they didn't want the people coming out to Hilltop because they figured they'd be parking
right
out there and then using
that
as an entrance.
That idea, but we also have a sidewalk issue.
You mean along the road?
Along the road. And that's...
It wasn't a sidewalk parallel with Hilltop. It was sidewalks from the building out to Hilltop.
Okay.
And he recommended we take them out to try to keep the traffic coming from to Hilltop.
Yeah. Trustee Rounder, were you? Did you have any follow-up?
Just to follow up to that, so there won't be a sidewalk along the street?
Not along the street, no. Okay. Just from Hilltop to the building. There'll be one
main
sidewalk
entrance
to the front entrance of the building.
But they used to have sidewalks going into the separate units
right
of the building. So there are multiple sidewalks from the building out to the
correct
building.
Correct.
Which seemed to cause parking problem.
So this is really the back of the building, even though it's facing the residents. Because they'll be entering
the address
from
side of the building, so it's would be considered the front of the building.
Right.
The entrance, everybody would be coming. And you do have in your packet, I think you have a picture of the back.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is the main entrance that everybody would be using, but it would be considered the back of the building.
It actually looks very much like the front, right?
Yeah. Correct. It's still, it's just staggered opposite, correct?
Yeah.
Trustee Genrich, I'll come back to you, Trustee Rafferty.
Yeah, I guess more of a comments than questions at this point. I appreciate the fact it looks like we've had 18 to 20 different things that you were asked to work on, and you did, and we certainly appreciate that. I know there's a lot of sensitivity to the other neighbors and what they would like to see here. The good news is I think we went from 74 to 48 units.
Correct.
And the suggested rents will be higher.
Correct.
Which should have a positive effect. But since tonight's the night to talk about neighborhood associations, I would hope that Hillcrest and their management would try to be involved in the neighborhood association, encourage the tenants to do so as well, since those don't just have to be property owners. And I think if we can, the more time we can spend together knowing each other, then maybe we can head off some of the potential problems that could exist down the road. And then the parking thing, maybe we need to address at a different different meeting, or the concerns about parking on that street and the speed.
Well, I'm sure at any of their meetings, if we're notified of them, I'm sure that we certainly would have a representative there to know what the concerns are. I mean, as far as speeding down streets and stuff like that, I guess we don't have so much control over
right
some of that stuff. But if there's things going on, that there's garbage getting thrown places and stuff like that, if there's neighborhood meetings and we're invited to them, I'm certain someone would be there to represent us, so to cooperate with the neighbors. I mean, and I know, they prefer to park there, and obviously that's just not feasible. So. But we certainly would cooperate with any of that kind.
Will there be an on-site manager, live-in manager?
Yes.
Okay.
I wasn't paying attention. It's now 7:45, and Trustee Harris arrived at 7:30. Trustee Rafferty, back to you.
Just a comment. Last year sometime, or much earlier this year, there was a board meeting and I think it was Windmere. Is that the project on Riverside? It was the senior facility right by the correctional facility. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was in the audience, and in fact, President Benenavin made comment that they worked very well together with the neighborhood. And so the developer made changes based on input from the residents. And I was very impressed with that. And if we could, in the future, really engage the neighborhood or encourage our developers to do so prior to, in terms of maybe looks and if there's something you can do, like either Mr. Sherman or Mr. Moore said, you know, like Walgreens, is there something different color brick that you could use that wouldn't cause that? I don't know. But I was, this discussion brings that back, and it would be nice if our developers could really work with our local community.
Comment I'd like to touch on for that, and we were the engineer on the Windermere project as well.
Could you give your
Bob Mock, Mock 4 Engineering and Surveying.
Thank you.
And we took some of the things from that process. You'll see, like, the location we have our dumpster at, that was a big issue with the Windermere. We have that located centrally in the site, away from the residences, so when they do come for the loading, that's as minimal of an issue as possible. We've added the landscape berm on the southwest corner and shielding Mr. Moore's home. We've also addressed some of the off-site drainage issues in the area that aren't necessarily this site's problems, but there's like some nuisance water basically in the southwest, southeast corners where everyone has built their yards up through time and it comes to there and there's no outlets. We've now provided outlets for those things. So there's a handful of little things like that we've done to this to help out the neighborhood situation and take care of some of those other issues that aren't necessarily directly related to this, but things that could be taken care of fairly easily. So.
Okay. Trustee Dennis?
In relation to the water law is, and what you just mentioned, I think it was more clarification. The old building, in the garages in the basement, you were swimming in those garages. They were horrible. So what have you done to improve, correct, or change the foundations on which that building is being built, again, in relation to water drainage away from that building? To what point?
Well, for starters, we're not putting underground garages in floodplains.
That's a good idea.
This property, as it was mapped in the recent floodplain remapping, the only floodplain that actually exists is right around the very perimeter. Which means it's close. We've still designed the whole project to meet floodplain requirements. The first floor of the building is 2.4 feet above the base flood elevation. If it were in the floodplain, it'd be required to be 2 feet. The garages are 1.4 above. They could legally be right at the floodplain. So everything on this site is elevated above the floodplain elevation. We've provided stormwater management to address quantity of runoff to help minimize off-site flooding and loads on the village storm sewer. This site will discharge significantly less, or it'll discharge a similar amount of water, but at a lower rate than the previous site did. It will actually discharge at rates comparable to pre-development conditions. And then a couple things we did along the perimeters to add some drainage in those areas where typically in the past water has just stood until it soaked in or evaporated, which in these soils, with the weather like we have been having, takes a while. So,
no, my concern is that with the water table level is a 10-year high, and it's the concern is that the water come from not necessarily from the floodplain itself, from the spillage, but rather from water table level up, and that was my primary thought and concern.
Well, this will be, to get quickly.
And I understand without now not having garages, that's tremendous. I get that.
And there will be no basements in any of this. This will just be
crawl space or anything along that.
Nothing. 4 foot frost walls and highest point on the site. This building is going to be about a foot and a half higher than the old building. So those foundations will be bearing on, I don't want to say dry in that area, but better soils. Sure.
and the aesthetics of the outside are going to be, it's not going to be that colored brick that you have in that picture. Right?
That's correct.
That's just the purpose, that's strictly yes. purposes of visual.
And it's going to have white accents. It'll have white soffit, cornice fascia, the pillars, the decks. It'll be white. The windows will be white. So it'll be, you know, it'll bring the colors out more. You know, again, professionally landscaped, so that'll have a lot to do with it as you go around the outside. Talking back a little bit about the neighborhood watch. Or the committees, we certainly, I mean, even to this point, we've tried to cooperate best we could, but as far as the road was the main concern coming out the hilltop, and that got eliminated, so we have the berm there. Hopefully we're blocking all the lights, and with the garage on that side, I think we've done a good job of all that stuff, so we're certainly trying to cooperate best we can with all this stuff, and in the future too, because obviously we want this apartment to, we want people to be proud of this apartment, and I know there were some issues last time, but we think this is an upscale apartment, and I think that it's going to be a nice addition to the neighborhood. I realize it's a bittersweet issue from the tragedy from last fall of what happened, but we're excited about the new project.
Is Hillcrest actively involved in any neighborhood associations currently? Can you recall Hillcrest representatives attending neighborhood association meetings?
Personally, I guess, not that I'm aware of, no. And that's not to say they're not, but I personally, I don't know that.
Mm-hmm. We don't have one to attend.
No, but Hillcrest doesn't. I assume you have complexes and properties in other communities besides Alloway. So that was my question. Anything further? Okay, we will. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything from the village staff? Okay, we'll take up the rule. I'll entertain a motion. Trustee Gass.
I'll make a motion that the board approve the site plan for the Village View Apartments upon satisfaction of the plan commission recommendation and requirements and village conditions as set forth in Mr. Fuller's May 29th memorandum.
Is there a second? Trustee Dart?
I'll second that.
Discussion? Trustee Guest?
No, I think it's a good project. I mean, I think that the developer has worked closely with the village staff, and I think they have heard some of the concerns of some of the residents. I've reviewed Mr. Fuller's memo. Lots of different issues came up, and I think that it appears that the developers made good faith efforts to comply with those requirements. And I think the question you asked of Mr. Fuller initially, you know, kind of sets the stage. I mean, this isn't a PDD process, it's an ordinance. You know, essentially, you know, they've complied with the ordinances, and you know, so I think they're entitled to the site plan approval, because this is, you know, you comply with our ordinance, you get to build what you want to build. As I reviewed the memo that Trevor prepared, a number of things in here seem to me not to be ordinance required at all. But the developer has gone above what's been required by our ordinances to try to pacify the village and try to make this a smooth project. So I think they've done what they need to do to get approval by the village for this site plan and to move it forward. And I think Trustee Genrich's comments are well taken, too. This is a much smaller complex than the last one, from 74 to 48. It's a significant investment in the village to the tune of about $4.5 million. Which, you know, it definitely has laudable effects in terms of the tax, you know, revenue for the parcel. And I think they did a nice job and made it look good, and I think that they're willing to work with the neighbors if issues do come up. I think Mr. Shimon's comments are well taken, you know, in terms of, you know, the traffic and the speed on the adjoining streets. And my recommendation is that we approve the project, and lots of efforts have been taken to try to mitigate the traffic congestion and parking on Hilltop, some of the other adjoining streets. And I think that it's our job that once this is built to monitor those situations, and it is our prerogative. If traffic is a problem and parking is a problem, we can control that. if speeding or the speed levels on that road are a problem, we can control that. So I think that it bears monitoring after construction. We should be vigilant in that, and we hope that the residents are vigilant in that, and if there are problems with that, we can address that at the board level, but it's not a developer issue. If we're going to eliminate parking, it's our prerogative to eliminate parking, should we choose to, and should there be a need to do so. So I think, you know, it's something that's in progress and in development, and we'll monitor it after construction. If there's some other issues that we can deal with as a board, then we'll take those up at the appropriate time. But I think it's a good project. I think they're deserving of approval since they have, in fact, complied with the ordinances, and in several respects have gone above ordinance requirements. So I think they're entitled to their approval.
Thank you. Trustee Dark.
Well, I don't think Trustee Gingrich left much unsaid, but he pretty much covered it. But they, working on plan commission and on the board, they have gone through a lot of changes and a lot of requirement changes, and have tried to improve from the first rendering that we've seen. I know that one of the things the plan commission looked at was they didn't like the straight across siding all across the garage. But I don't believe there was anything in the ordinances or the zoning that required them to change it, but they did break it up with brick to make it more appealing. So they did things like that, and they did listen. And I think they've complied with everything they need to comply with, and I don't see why we would not give him them go ahead on this project. I think it's a good project.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to? Trustee Gass was right. I think the original distinction between the PDD process and the site plan review process is an important one to set the stage, in that you're never going to please everyone aesthetically. And I think that Hillcrest has done the best they can to make it as aesthetically pleasing to the largest number of people. We can always argue that something should be different, but that at some point we just have to sort of agree to disagree and move forward. They've met all the requirements for the site plan review process, and as others have said, they've even gone above and beyond in some respects. The parking I see is a huge issue that we do have to monitor. I don't think the elimination of the sidewalks is going to make a bit of difference. If people can park on that side, they're going to come out wherever they come out, whether it's the main entrance or their individual apartment, and they're going to go across the lawn to their cars. So, so I think it's going to be more of a parking issue than it is anything to do with sidewalks or anything on the actual property. when we started this process, if you recall, there was a call out to make this process much more engaging with the residents, and to put a property on there that would eliminate many of the problems that we saw in the previous property, and I think this is going to do it. I remember residents complaining about garbage and about people, you know, coming home at 2:33 in the morning and waking up. I think much of that is going to be eliminated, not only because of the fewer number of units in the complex, but the clientele that it attracts. And so I see no reason that we shouldn't go ahead with this project either. I do want people to know that Hillcrest Lumber was very open to a number of very creative possibilities for that property, many of which you don't see any sign of here. And we're very open, but for a number of reasons, some of those options couldn't be pursued. But I found them to be very open to innovative and new ideas along the way. Anybody else?
Just one thought, and that is that after all of this, I hope that both the local residents and Hillcrest use this as a beginning point in their relationship, and that we're able to build from there as far as communication. And
I think it's come a long way. I mean, like the others have said, a lot of these plans have changed based on, some of it was mandated because of, you know, stormwater or from the power company, but some of it was completely aesthetic and for the wishes of the village board and the village residents. Anything further? Trustee Guest.
Just one more comment, as unrelated to this project, you know, because I think they have done what they needed to do. But I think, you know, as a board, you know, we have to be mindful of just how far we can or should go. Granted, the PDD process, this is not a PDD, but it allows for the village to have much more flexibility. And sometimes that's a good thing, but sometimes that can be an onerous thing. I mean, I think there's been times in some of the past PDD projects where we have been, a little bit too hard or too strict, you know, with the developers. Just because, you know, part of our goal or our objective in this community is to, you know, encourage, you know, commercial development and you know, complexes like these. And I've had discussions with some people who've done some significant projects now, and they said they wouldn't do them here anymore because they were just too cost prohibitive with all these little nicety things that we insisted upon them. So I think just as a matter of policy going forward, as these things happen and come up, we have to be mindful of the cost and the benefit to the developers as well. I mean, we always need to be sensitive to our residents, and we should be. But we also, I think, have to be a little bit more cognizant going forward of developers and their needs and their costs and their budgets, because I think, to a certain extent, we're chasing or have the possibility of chasing, you know, business and development away from Alvin, because I think some other communities are much more accommodating. So that's more of a policy thing as we wrestle with these issues in the future, but I think these folks have done what they need to do.
No, I agree with you. It's always a balancing act. I think Alloway is sort of unique in a number of ways. One, our residential history, and in fact, we have no industrial and scarce commercial and a lot of nonprofit. And so I think village boards and residents alike are sort of pretty conservative when it comes to the scarce number of properties we have with regard to commercial. And I think our walkable, sustainable history and theme throughout our comprehensive plan suggests that we want development that's consistent with that theme. And sometimes that runs counter to some of the things that, that businesses want to do. But I agree with you wholeheartedly, and it's something, it's a balancing act in the struggle that we're not going to eliminate. But we do have to be cognizant. We don't want to get the reputation of being unsympathetic or anti-business in the village. And I think there are ways that we can preserve our history that's in the comprehensive plan and still be welcoming to businesses. Anything further? Okay, there's a motion on the floor. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Item 7, action regarding ordinance 2014-14, amending section 6.02, animals at large, and 6.06, dogs and cats in parks or on premises other than that of the owner. Chapter 6, animals, this is from the 6th of May. Is there a motion with regard to this item? Trustee Raptor.
I'll move to approve.
I almost forgot your name. I was going to call you Jim.
That's my name, too.
Trustee Raptor.
I move to approve.
Is there a second? Trustee Gass, second. Discussion? Mr. Roberts, you have anything you want to add from the last go-around we had with this ordinance?
Or the go-around before that.
Yeah. Thank you for making those changes.
She did most of the work for me.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries as well. Action regarding ways to reinvigorate the neighborhood watch. I will suspend the rules for a second and have CEO Lapna address the board.
As we talked about last time, just ways to get people re-involved, contact those groups that are out there. I will certainly be making an effort to advertise, so to speak, whether it's on our website, Facebook, email list that I do have, to do our best to make contact with any groups that are out there or open it up to any individuals that would be willing to start a new neighborhood watch group. I also got a message from Trustee Dennis. There may be some information or from the Novaks at Webster Avenue Market that they have been involved in the past, so I'm going to make sure I get in touch with them and see if they have any ideas and what they have to say or how things have worked in the past, and go from there. I've also been in close contact with Officer Jed Bradley from the Pier Police Department. He's their community relations officer, I guess. I don't know if that's his official title. But he's been a good resource. De Pier has many neighborhood watch groups that he's involved with there. So also get some ideas from him on what we can do to go forward.
So what are you looking for from the board, the EO now? I know that we had a discussion last time that your time is pretty precious and you can't do everything all the time. Are you looking for the board to sort of direct your efforts in this direction versus others, or what would...
Not necessarily.
I mean, is that what you're asking with regard to the item being on the agenda?
I guess that was going to be my question for you as far as action taken. What do you like me to... Is there any specifics, or just go forward with what I'm kind of planning, like I just discussed?
Okay.
If you have any ideas, I'm certainly...
Okay. All right. Is there any input from our visitors? Yes, sir.
Make the non-emergency allied police number more prevalent.
Could you state your name and address, please?
Darren Atkins, 3611 Sunny Slope Street.
Thank you.
Can I ask that what would be?
Non-emergency number more prevalent.
Would you be referring to the number to the Village Hall office or the non-emergency number for the communications center? Because I guess the problem is if you call the Village Hall and they put you through the police office, if I'm off on vacation, nobody's going to get that message for dial back. So if you're calling for a call for service, I would recommend calling the Brown County Communications Center. If you're looking to get a hold of me directly, you can always call this number. It's obviously not an emergency.
Okay, well, to prevent us using 911 and it's really not an emergency situation, perhaps it's somebody new to the neighborhood that raises a concern. If you don't want us dialing alloy, then tell us the number we should dial.
The number's on the website and in the police section. I know we have the Brown County Communications Center phone number on there for non-emergency issues.
Perhaps for those of us who are not as internet savvy, that could be bannered. So if you have an issue like that, and you direct us to the website, it's absolutely obvious to you. Okay, don't like the look of this person, I'll call this number.
Thank you. Anyone else who has some input with regard to this issue? Yes, sir. I'm going to make you.
Mark Schutte, 350 Tax Street. A few years ago, we had an officer, I think, Flannery, or had a newsletter. I'm not sure if the value of it or what your consideration cost the benefits, but several people emailed it to me, and we looked at it. It was maybe a bi-monthly email, and I know you can sign up for it. And gave little tips, heads up on what was going on in the neighborhood. I remember we had instances someone driving our driveway at night, late at night, and was kind of wondering if they were scoping out their house or not. But I remember reading in the email that it broke up an underage beer party in the block next door. Yeah. It just made sense. That was what was going on. So it was just a little help.
They were coming through.
Right. Yes, sir.
What would be the feasibility or cost of having fridge magnets made with the number on it?
I have no idea. We can check that out. That's pretty inexpensive.
When I used to have sitters, I would leave that local number on my fridge. And I said, if you get really, really scared, that's the number to call.
Right.
It might be a very simple and cost-effective way to get the word out and do a mailing and have folks, so they can stick it right in there. They don't have to go to websites or anything. They just look on their fridge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anyone else who has an idea for the EO lot now? Okay, we will take up the rules. Trustee Harris.
Isn't there currently a monthly email that summarizes different police activity that has taken place?
There is still a newsletter I do every month.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the Village website. I have an email list. It's not nearly as extensive as the one Flannery had when he was here. So if you contact me, I'd be more than happy to get you on the email list and direct you to where that newsletter is.
Have you seen that newsletter, sir?
No.
Okay. I think Trustee Raptor was mentioning this a few meetings ago, and that it would be really nice if we had a web system where someone could come in and just a pull-down menu of all the things that you want to get notifications on, and this could be on it, that if you want the monthly newsletter with regard to activity, you can get it. But we're simply not there yet, and it's not a matter of, you know, not having time, because the EO lot now is doing it. It's a matter of that list of those neighborhood watch members, plus some, I think, was pretty extensive,
yeah.
And we need to repopulate that list.
Right.
Trustee Guest.
Well, and maybe that's the place to start. I mean, if we have a list, and I understood it used to be a bigger list, and I don't understand why we don't have a bigger list, but that might be a whole separate issue. But we should have a bigger list. But, you know, and maybe, you know, I think you're doing an excellent job trying to reinvigorate this, but we already have these people that are interested. So maybe we invite all of them to some function here at the Village Hall and try to get this organized and get them back up and running, because we have people that are interested, but I think we just need to get them to somehow congregate in one spot so we can get everybody organized on the same page. And then we can maybe figure out what they want, what kind of village support they'd like to receive, and at least I think that'd be a brilliant way to just, you know, start the process, you know, and invite them all to something and give them some food and drink and, you know, send them down here and figure out what they want and get them organized and get some captains and start that process. But I think that's a good way to do it, because we have people that are interested, so just let's invite them to something and have them sit down and figure out how to make this better.
I think there should be I'm thinking about our presentation. I'm interested in the neighborhood association idea, and I think this should be sort of a gateway or a stepping stone to that. I don't want this just be about safety. I want it to be about community, and safety would be a part of the community.
Trustee Gass was saying I still do have a meeting quarterly for a public safety meeting, and I get the same 7 or 8 people that come every time. So I think it's just a matter of reaching out, getting in touch with people, and
I think it's
an efficient way to do that.
Yeah, but I also think it's about how we frame it, and that neighborhood watch association, when that list was highly populated, they were doing more than just sort of safety and neighborhood watch things. They were developing community. I know they had sort of, some of these neighborhood watch groups had social functions. They were starting to behave much more like neighborhood associations than neighborhood watch. And so I think that's the kind of vision that I would like to see. Trustee Dennis.
Talking about was I back trailed on Officer Flannery and went back to Webster Avenue Market and met with the younger Mike. And those files are actually, with those connections and names, are actually at the Webster Avenue Market in a black file cabinet on register number 7, which has been sitting there for the last few years, locked and unattended to because nobody knew what to do with it.
Huh.
And no one knew whose possession it was, whether it was the village of Alloway, whether it was the sheriff's department, whether it was... Mike said he knew it wasn't his. And he said, frankly, he said, if you took it right now and put it in the back of your car, I wouldn't care. No, I did not. Because D.E. Olaf now would be following me around. So what's all in there, I'm not sure, but I would put a dollar to a donut that the majority of what he had was in there. Mike also said that if we wanted to be able to set up a table again, like Officer Flannery did with, not necessarily with DEO Lockdown, but with the cadets, so that kids or people from the community could touch base, just as a face of the community, they'd be more than willing to donate that space again and reactivate that and to be able to do it. But it is still sitting there. I looked before I came down tonight, and that file cabinet is still sitting there. So.
And since I got your message, recently, basically, I've been working on the next agenda item, the sex offender numbers and the research I've been doing. But when I got your message, I do have a ring of keys in my office that are labeled no idea. So it's very possible when I got your message, it's very possible one of them might be for that cabinet. So I'll be heading up there tomorrow to take a look and see if we have.
I've got a few dozen of those, too, if you want to add to your collection.
If you head up there tomorrow and happen to find that list, because it's been a topic of conversation for 4 years, I think, would you email us and let us know?
Yes.
Thank you.
Might find out where Jimmy Hoff is.
Yeah, might be someone who won't want to know.
Is there a motion with regard to this item? I'm not feeling that we need to. I need to entertain a motion. Do you get a sense of that the board wants you to continue down this path and kind of where we're hoping that you're going with regard to reinvigorating not only Neighborhood Watch, but the idea of neighborhood associations?
Yes.
So there's no motion with regard. Is everything finished for the allotment? Do you have anything else that you want to add?
No, we'll keep going ahead until we do something going.
Okay. If anyone has additional thoughts with regard to how to reinvigorate Neighborhood Watch or to develop further develop neighborhood associations, feel free to contact a board member or DEO Lapno so that we can coordinate this more quickly and efficiently. Trustee Harris, did you?
The only thing I'd look for is just if we set up something along the lines of the first meeting of each month is a regular update in terms of where things are standing, how things are progressing, if you need any help from the board. That's the only thing I'd be looking for.
Let me try to coordinate that. I know you're going to be hopefully taking a vacation sometime this summer, so it might not work out, but if it's sort of a once-a-month update running item on the agenda so that we don't lose track of it, then
sure.
Thank you. Okay. Is there a motion with regard to item 8? Hearing none, the item dies for lack of a motion. A motion, not E motion. Item 9, action regarding sexual offender residency ordinance. I will suspend the rules and entertain some discussion from DEO LOTMAP with regard to this issue. You should have had at your seats a report that DEO LOTMAP generated.
Yep. And again, I apologize for not getting to you ahead of time, but I got it done myself at about 4 o'clock this afternoon with the numbers that I get provided to me. It's come down to sorting through each and every one of them and trying to make sense of it and some organization. Like we talked about the last meeting, trying to get a history of offenders in Alloway compared to other communities. What it comes down to with the Department of Corrections and the registry, they don't keep very good records of past records. They have the current registry and where sex offenders are currently registered as living. The question came up as far as, you know, our offenders that were in Alloway or that are in Alloway, did they live in Alloway when they committed their crimes? What it comes down to, I talked to the registry about that. It would come down to looking at each individual police report or looking at the case file from whatever DA's office prosecuted them to find out what their original address was. What I did do was go on Wisconsin Circuit Court Access, CCAT, is what we call it, and looking at each individual, you can get a address that's listed on there. I can't tell you it's 100% accurate because they do change that address in CCAT as the defendant. If they're not incarcerated, they move around. So that address does get updated as usual. So I think in some cases it may be accurate that that's their address and that's where they stayed throughout their court process. But if they moved in that court process, it's, you know, very possible that it's not an accurate address. But looking at those numbers, when I looked right on CCAT, there were 4 offenders that are currently registered in Alloway that had an Alloway address during their court process at one point or another, at least. There were 6 others that had Green Bay addresses, and then there are many more, like I listed here, that had addresses in Superior, Chicago, Milwaukee, Pulaski, Washera County, out of state, North Carolina, Algoma, Hartford, Denmark, Massachusetts, Shawano. I think I forgot to put Ohio on there as one of the out of state offenders that's currently registered in Alloway. So, you know, it comes from places all over the place across the board. The first sheet I provided was the up-to-date numbers and list of offenders that are registered in the Village of Valley right now. Even since April when this discussion has started, I think I had 27. We've had 2 more added since then. So as of last week, we're up to 29. The list contains all of the registered offenders minus the ones that were juveniles when they committed them. When they committed their offenses, that information is not public record like the rest of the registry is. So this is about the only piece of information I received from Department of Corrections that was organized, I guess, so to speak. Basically, all I had to do was hit print on this, and this is the first time I've seen the sheet in this format, so hopefully that trend will continue where they actually have information organized. Like I said in past meetings, before this, all I get is a spreadsheet by area code or zip code, and then I sit down and pick through or pick up the alleyway addresses and try to organize it from there. I was able to look back at my own records that I have kept in the past few years, as well as the records that I had on my computer from Dan Sandberg when he was the DEO, going back to 2008. And what I was able to come up with on the next sheet, I just put on a small graph. 2008, we had 12 registered sex offenders that have been placed from Sandberg's files. And obviously, there's an increase across the board with a bit of a spike in 2013. Like probably during the summer there was 6-7 dim. And all of that information is on the list that I have been providing.
Yep. When did you take over as DEO?
Late summer 2011.
And so that your first report on this, I'm sorry, your first report on this is August 2012, is that right?
I think so.
And it's basically the same number as DEO Sandberg's.
Right.
So the increase that we see, that we see from 2012 on is using the same methodology.
Yeah,
a difference in the person who's collecting the data can't describe that increase because you've been doing it since 2012.
Right.
Thank you, Trustee Gass.
No, and you may not have the answer, but you know, the number was stable for quite a few years between 08 and April of 2013, and it varied from 12 to 19 in that period. And then we got a spike just between April to November from 19 to 25, and now four more since November. I mean, is there anything, you know, particular that we can attribute that spike to? Because it seems to be grown quite significantly in a relatively short period of time.
I guess I can't say.
I'm sure I'm going to interrupt for a second. Can we all make sure to speak really directly into the microphone there? So we can't hear DEO a lot now. Let me see if I can. I'm going to turn everything up a little bit if it's too loud right now.
There's probably a number of different factors, but is there anything in your mind that you look at and go, you know, here's a couple of the big reasons for the spike? Because I know the Green Bay ordinance has been in place for several years before that, but there didn't seem to be that spike we've seen in the very recent past.
Yep. I guess I can't give you a for sure reasoning or for sure answer. Could it have something to do with that the alley ordinance is less restrictive, so maybe it is somewhere where offenders may look to move? That's certainly a possibility past that. You know, it's anybody's guess. The next page that I provided was the breakdown by offense and the percentages, like I had provided in the past, with the current 29 offenders in alleyway. Past that, the next page is the breakdown by offense that I had provided at the past meetings and the percentages that we talked about. Those are based on the statute only, and that's how they're divided up. Past that one, the next chart I was able to make is alleyway compared to the rest of Brown County back in 2008. That was one of the spreadsheets that someone at the Department of Corrections still had on file that they were able to send me. So that goes back to the 12, as we talked about earlier in 2008, compared to 514 in the rest of Brown County. And again, it's broken down simply by offense. And kind of a percentage so we can get an idea in comparison. The next one was a breakdown of just the 54301 area code. I had a couple of those that I had saved that had the entire area code in it, but what I typically done is when I got the spreadsheet for 54301, I picked up the alley ones and shortened it up for my own uses, so I didn't necessarily have it for every year. But if you look at 54301 as a whole, we have 29 now in alleyway, 55 in the rest of 54301. A question that came up was probably, you know, how does that compare to population? So I made a note on that. in my paragraph on the bottom there, according to online records, the total population of the 54301 area code is approximately 22,434. According to our own website, now population is approximately 13,932. So we're about 62% of that 54301 area code. I was able to do the same thing for November 2013 on the next page. And then I also had the spreadsheet from 2008 that I was provided by from the DOC in the 5431 area code. I was able to do the same thing. So, you know, across the board, there's an increase in numbers. And, you know, whether it's in Green Bay or Brown County as a whole, that number is, you know, going to continue to increase as people are convicted, you know, do their sentence and are released in the community.
And they actually register. And that's part of the theory of all of this, is that it encourages people to register instead of coming.
Right.
I was a little bit surprised. I haven't had a lot of time to look through this, but I expected that it might be the opposite, that the proportion of offenders in Alloway isn't different. It's not disproportionate to the surrounding communities, including the both 54301 and the county, but that the type might be because of the specific case that we've been hearing about lately. But I'm kind of seeing the opposite. I was really surprised that we grew from 12 to 29, and I know this has happened within the past, you know, year, from 2013 on, that we've seen this bump. But we've gone from 12 to 29, and the county has gone from 514 to 521, if I'm reading this correctly.
Right.
So we've over doubled, and the county overall is about stable, maybe up a couple of percent. That's something is alarming to me, and is kind of concerning to me. The type of offenses obviously is of concern to me, but the numbers are so small that it's hard to work with those percentages.
Yeah,
you go from 1 to 2 and you've just doubled your percentage. And
right. And, you know, I know we've said in past meetings when we have Department of Corrections here, the laws that are in place don't necessarily have anything to do with, you know, the association between the type of offense and where anybody could live.
Right.
So there's nothing dictating that at this point.
Well, sort of, but I think Trustee Gass is going to weigh on this, and that in this case of Mr. Bryant, it really did, because it was a particular type of offense that made the review board reconsider and basically kick him out of Green Bay.
Right.
So I understand what you're saying, but I think we're getting to the point now where the type of offense really is starting to dictate where some can live in terms of the municipality that they can live in.
And, you know, and throughout this whole thing, I've just been trying to gather the most accurate data possible.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, you can make a decision on if you want to take action to change our ordinance or whatever the case may be.
We had a challenge by Mr. Schutte to make sure that we collected as much data as we could and got as much information as we could and verified, established the validity of the information, which is, that last part is sort of hard to do. But he made the point that a lot of these studies were done by the Department of Corrections, or the data is being supplied by the county, or
right.
And these entities are motivated to try to find places for folks. That's their job. The DOC's
yep.
job is to try to help people to find. So I personally went and dug out, I've got two of these binders full from 2007 and dug out all these research studies, and I'm still relatively convinced that having overly restrictive residency policies is not a good idea and leads to some unanticipated negative impacts. But I'm alarmed at the data that you showed us, just in terms of the numbers, not the types of offenses, and I have a problem, and I think Trustee Gass will weigh in this, with the process that our neighbors have used to basically shun the worst offenders and encourage them to move into places like Alloway where they can take up residence. So with that, I think I'll acknowledge Trustee Gast and let him weigh in.
No, and I agree with a lot of what President Bandanov had said. I mean, back shortly after Green Bay adopted its ordinance, I was one of the few on the board that wanted Alloway to adopt the identical ordinance. And then we heard from quite a few different folks from law enforcement and the correctional system, and they said that, you know, those overly restrictive ones like Green Bay are not necessarily good policy because they tend to drive people underground and you don't know where they are at all. And I fully expect that that's true. I think there are a lot of people, a lot of sex offenders living in Green Bay that just don't register because they know they can't live there. They went to the review board, they couldn't get approval, so they just live there in silence and nobody knows where they are. And that, I think, is the worst result because nobody knows where they are. So I think, you know, an unduly restrictive version like Green Bay's is not good policy. And for all the years, you know, since then, we've been monitoring, you know, this and receiving some data, not as detailed as this. Now, this is excellent. We've done a wonderful job accumulating this. This is the best data I've seen. And what we heard through all those years of monitoring since Green Bay adopted their ordinance is we're not getting a disproportionate amount. You know, we're not seeing a dramatic increase, and, you know, which made our initial decision, you know, right. But I'm very troubled because it's the first time I've seen it. And it's probably a good idea that it's probably about the only good situation that came about this whole Brandt situation as we took a close look at the data. Because, I mean, it's shocking. You know, April 2013, 19, that was still stable from the predecessor years. But between April of 2013, just a year ago, I mean, we've bumped from 19 to 29. I mean, that is shocking. So I think our overall ordinance needs to be looked at to see, you know, where we can tighten it up. But the one thing that troubles me the most is that Green Bay, in the Brandt situation, they approved it. And then, you know, their neighborhoods complained, and then they revoked his approval and sent him off, and now he's an issue in one of our neighborhoods. And that's not right. I mean, these people have to have, I mean, they're released, okay? They've served their time, whatever that time is, and they're released, and they have to go someplace. You know, and with the premise or the assumption being that all communities share in that situation, okay, so be it. You know, if we all have to share in it, and nobody's taking a disproportionate hit, then okay, that's what we do. Because they have to be, you know, put back into society, and they have to, you know, try to become good citizens. You know, as long as one community isn't bearing a disproportionate share of that, then okay, and if we're all equally sharing it, then okay. But Brandt, you know, brings one critical, you know, point is Green Bay got rid of him. You know, they approved him, the neighborhoods said no, and Green Bay said no, get out. And now here he is in Alloway. And we've heard, and I think very, very compelling statements from the residents that this has thoroughly disrupted their neighborhood. And my view of this is that you know, we should charge our village council. And we can look at the overall restrictiveness of our ordinances and weigh in on that in a more reasoned approach. But it just seems to me that our village council should look at the one legality, and I don't see any problem with even why it wouldn't be legal, but to basically craft an ordinance for the village of Alloway that says, look, if any other municipality or any board of any other municipality or any committee of any other municipality rejects somebody for their community, they're automatically rejected for Alloway. I mean, because in the Brandt situation, you know, we got somebody that somebody else didn't want. But they got to say they didn't want it. And so now here he is in one of our community, in one of our neighborhoods. So I think at a minimum, what we should explore is just something that says, look, if you get thrown out of a neighboring community and they say they don't want you and they won't let you live in their community, then you can't come to Alloway either. You know, I mean, because it's not right. You know, this situation is just not right. You know, because we didn't get a choice in the matter. Green Bay got a choice in the matter. Mm-hmm. You know, and they said no. You know, after neighbors complain, now we have to hear our neighbors complain. I mean, if we're sharing the burden equally with Green Bay, then so be it. Then we share the burden. But in this particular instance, Green Bay got to say no, and he had to go someplace, and he came to our community. So I think we should explore at least that option to say if you're rejected by another community, you can't live in another community, then you just can't come to Alloway either, because why should we bear that burden?
I agree wholeheartedly with what you said. This is a unique situation, but I have a feeling it might not be as unique as it had been in the past. And I'm uncomfortable with the process the way that it happened the first time. I'm even more uncomfortable. I've gotten emails from Mrs. Schout. She's not here tonight. Who's added quite a bit of insight to this. The same research that I'm relying on, and not all of it's from the Department of Corrections, there are academic journals from psychologists and sociologists that have established that this is not a great idea to have an overly restrictive policy, but that same literature also suggests that there are environments in which offenders tend to thrive, and we've heard about them before, when they have support systems, when they're living with family members, when they have jobs. What Green Bay has done is basically taken Mr. Brandt out of that kind of situation and put him into a situation where he's more likely to fail and reoffend. And so the whole process really bothers me, especially because the logic of doing it in Green Bay originally was so that the other communities shared in the burden, as Trustee Gast said, of trying to find and integrate offenders into their communities because they were suspecting that Green Bay had a disproportionate number. And it's just working out in the opposite direction from the numbers that I've seen. So I would very much would like to support exploring at least that option. I'm in no way ready to adopt a residency ordinance anything close to what Green Bay is doing, but I don't like the idea of us not having a say in sort of taking those folks who are rejected from Green Bay. One other element that really bothers me is I read the minutes of the hearing that Mr. Brandt had in front of the board the second time after the residents complained, and it was a three-person board. I think there were five on the board, but three were there, and it was a 2-1 vote. And the one dissenting vote said, look, there aren't communities that are going to say, yeah, we'll take this person in, and so we have to do our part, and she was ignored. And they have no process on that board for revisiting an issue, and so they were just sort of making it up as they went along and ended up sort of shuffling someone out of the community and directly into ours. And I just don't think that's a situation that we want to be in. Trustee Dart.
And maybe it's not reading this right, but I was reading DePere's ordinance on that, and maybe someone else is familiar with it, but theirs states it's more about reporting that before anyone can come in, and it's a reporting restriction. So they can't come in until they decide how they want to inform the neighborhood. I thought that was kind of a different way. It's a restriction, but they're not saying they're limiting them. But they're saying we want to know the amount or what kind of offense this is and decide on the notification before that person takes residence. And I think in this situation, at least then we would have some time to react.
And if you remember when we first started talking about this, we delineated two different issues, the notification and the actual ordinance, and we all were thinking, we can do a better job of notifying. Let's work on a system for making sure people know as soon as possible. But we don't seem to have a problem with regard to the ordinance. I think that we're now at the point where I'm seeing we might have a problem with the ordinance as well. I'm not sure I like the peers method, because every offender that comes into the community, you convene this board, that it makes more sense to me to have some sort of categories or some sort of criteria, and if it's in this category, this is the kind of notification it's given. If it's in that category, that kind of notification is given. And I know that there are some limits as to what we can do, simply because we're not notified in some cases until after the offender has already taken up residence in the village.
That's something I can talk to DePere further about. I was under the impression, speaking with the chief and Detective Matt Cluth from DePere, was heavily involved in their process, that they don't always necessarily get the notification and convene their board ahead of time. But when they find out an offender is moving in or has moved in, then they do it. I can contact them to get further details on how how they do it ahead of time to, you know, do their best to make sure they are on top of it.
It seems to me it'd be faster if we just had rules for it rather than having to convene a board, wait for the village board to convene or convene a special committee or something. That strikes me, if we just had an automatic when someone moves in and however we find out about it, if they're this level of crime, they fit in this category, this is how we identify residents as quickly as possible. Trustee Harris.
Diarmata, you said we don't really have the ability to look back at all data.
Right.
So, again, I know we've jumped from 18 and 19 as some of the numbers that you collected, but do we still have the information to go back and verify the 2008, 2010, 2011 numbers? Or is that, that information just exists as one spreadsheet, but we can't go back and look at the detail of the data?
What I got those numbers from is the files I have that were passed on to me from Dan Sandberg, who was in my position before me. So that's basically the exact list that I provided to the board over the years with their information, the offense, and so on. The only spreadsheets I was able to get from DOC on it were from 2008, and that was from Tom Smith from the Department of Corrections, who's involved with the registry, and he just happened to have a couple of those spreadsheets, I don't know, on his computer or wherever he had them, and he was able to send them to me. So it's tough to come up with the old information.
The reason I'm asking is I want to make sure if we're possibly making assumptions because of trend and one person used a certain methodology and now you're using maybe a different methodology, I want to make sure of the information first if we're comparing Alloway to the rest of 54301 or Brown County.
Well, I think in the past, you know, what we're talking about now and doing the comparisons was never on anybody's mind. So, you know, the information that I provide to the board as far as the numbers the past few years from 2008, I believe those are all accurate, and it's going to be basically the same, because I have been doing it basically the same as Dan Sandberg did it before me.
Okay.
So prior to that, I don't know exactly what the process was, but since 2008, I believe those numbers are accurate.
Well, even if you assume that Officer Sandberg did it differently, there's still a bump after the ELOP numbers.
Agreed.
Collecting the data. Trustee Dart.
In that bump, do we have any, and maybe I missed it and it's in here, evidence that these are more severe, the degree of offense is higher than...
That's the part that's kind of hard to determine because the numbers are...
Right. The numbers I guess are it would be like small. The new ones that just came in, they must be more current.
Oh, I see.
That moved in, and are they, you know, higher on the offense scale?
You know, either by the tables I made here, otherwise I could, you know, look at my list as they developed and
your list as they develop.
Right.
You know,
and,
if there is a trend, then yes, we are getting they're all more serious now.
These are also total numbers at any one point in time. So if an offender moves in that's second degree sexual assault of a child, but two move out, it would show a decrease, but one still moved in. That's something.
Okay. And, you know, I guess that brings up another point. It's constantly changing.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, maybe not on a daily basis here in Alloway, but, you know, overall in the county, I'm willing to bet there's new registrants calling in, reporting new matters pretty much on a regular basis. So it's tough to keep 100% accurate data for long.
DEO Lot, now, we mentioned the website last time, and I went there, and is it the same data that you've been working with? Because you're pulling it directly from the DOC. And
the only difference from where I get it, and then we're, assume we're talking about www.widocoffenders.org is the website that's directly to the Department of Corrections. The only difference from what you would be able to get compared to what I get is I have a login that I can go in specifically and I can get the information that from the offenders that were juveniles when they committed their crimes.
Okay.
So I would be able to see those But other than that, the information from that website is identical to what's available to the public. Anybody who's willing to look.
What is this registration start date? Is that the date that they registered?
Yeah, I think that's when they were ordered to, by the court after they, whether left their incarceration or whatever the case may be. That's
So those would be the newest. You could tell which ones were the most.
That's not necessarily to Alloy. I think that's when they were first on the registry itself, regardless of where they were.
Okay.
Yeah, because they had a registry end date then, which could be 2032 or something.
I typically, and if I remember correctly, what the DOC said when they're there, there's different levels of some of them are over 15 years on the registry, and others are lifetime. So.
Do we have any procedure in place where that our sexual offenders are checked in on, other than the Department of Correction or the parole offices or anything else? I mean, in our community alone, is there a process or?
What I've done in the past, several times a year, and this is very similar. I can talk to Detective Goof from Depere, they did quarterly. They go around and just knock on doors and see who's there. I've been doing that several times a year, focusing, just make sure I especially do it around Halloween time when there's additional restrictions of offenders not being able to put up decorations or answer the door, when kids are up and about at that time. So typically twice a year I try to go around and knock on doors, whether it's by myself or with someone from the Department of Corrections. And that was another part in talking to the Pure Police Department about their procedures. Will make that more regular.
I'm just thinking if that could be done by, the degree of their assaults. I mean, could you make a pattern that gets more visits with the higher degree of the crime?
Yeah, we can look into that. I mean, to be honest with you, if that's the direction you want to give me, I'm more than happy to do it. And I want
just
to be a community decision.
I don't know.
If you feel that's if you want me doing it more, then we'll do more.
Okay, Trustee Rappier.
Ever since we started talking about this, one of the things that bothered me most was the whole notification and us not knowing if a criminal comes out of when they leave jail and there's a plan by the DOC. The DOC approves a plan. They inform the community that they're going to move into of the plan. But then after that, if they move, we don't have to be notified until 10 days after they move and register. And I started looking at the heat map that Green Bay has for the 2,000 feet. There aren't a whole lot of spaces on the map left for anyone to live. So I did a little heat map of Alloway, and the same would be true in Alloway if 2,000 feet of a school or child care facility. If it wasn't for the child care over on Riverside, Taft Street, they could have moved in there because that's not 2,000 feet of any other facility. I don't know that a residency restriction would help. I did a little very unscientific survey myself, and I counted 25 people, three of which had lived in Alloy prior to their conviction. I just looked at their arrest record. And that bothers me. The folks from the neighborhood have said many times forgiveness. They believe in forgiveness and giving people a second chance. But my concern is that we're giving everyone else's problem a second chance as a community. And I don't think that's fair to our residents who should have a feeling of living in a secure neighborhood and knowing who's living around them. I would be in favor of changing our ordinance, I think, to something more along DePere's line where they do have a review board, because I have to believe we have the right to say, as a community, notify us if you're moving in and have us have the ability to say yes or no. I've done a lot, just like a lot of people have. I've looked at a lot of things, and you know, some of the logic that they use in placing people. You know, like Mr. Brandt, someone with a child sex offense history, they're dangerous when they're allowed to have a relationship or develop a relationship with a child. Well, it doesn't matter if that's a park or if it's a school or if it's a next-door neighbor. They have that opportunity. And I think we owe it to our residents and ourselves to make sure that we don't become the place where everyone wants to come because it's the easy place to come.
A couple of points for addressing. That's what the original intent was of our whole ordinance, is making sure that we knew where people were and that we tried to keep tabs on Alloway not being a dumping ground for Green Bay for all practical purposes. So that was the original intent of watching the data, and why the data since the last 9 months is so shocking to me, yep, is that I would have assumed that we were relatively stable or maybe a slight incline, and that maybe we were having a problem with the type of offenders, and so that's where I was focusing my attention.
It's
second
also
thing I want to ask is about the De Pere. I heard you say you like something relative similar to what De Pere is doing, mm-hmm, where they have a review board, but their review board is focusing on notifications, not
right,
residency.
I would probably take it a step further.
And so you're thinking more of what Green Bay is doing and having a review board.
Well, Green Bay has a residency requirement or restriction saying you can't live within 2,000 feet.
Right. I mean, we have a residency restriction. It's just not as restrictive,
right,
as Green Bay.
Right. Well, then I'd be wanting to do more along the lines of Green Bay, at least in terms of saying if you're moving in, we want to know about it. We want to have the ability to review whether or not you're doing what you're supposed to be doing coming out of jail.
Good.
One last thing,
yes,
if I may. One reason we may have had a spike, I don't know how long these guys go to jail for, but 10 of the 25 offenders have offended since the year 2000. So if they were in jail for 7 years, 10 years, they may all just be coming out and then trying to move back into their neighborhoods and not being able to, so they come to Alloway. That's only a guess. It's not scientific, but.
Trustee Gatt.
No, I was just going to say, I think the path going forward is essentially, you know, a three-pronged approach. You know, one is the notice requirement. We could do a review board like De Pere does, just in terms of notice and how that board determines notice. Or, as Mr. President, you know, suggested, just have an automatic response based upon severity of the offense. I'm more along those lines. I mean, if there's, you know, there's none of them are good, but there's certain categories that are just by their nature worse than others. And I think we could make categories. If it's this kind of offense, it triggers X response or X notification of the residents, and it's this kind of category, it determines Y notification of the residents. So I think that's one approach. And I'm still firmly convinced the second approach is to have Village Council explore an option or an ordinance that says if you're rejected by anybody else, you can't come here. And I think the third option, you know, the third thing that needs to look at in terms of residency you know, do we want to tighten our restrictions? You know, I view those as being the three separate issues that we're faced with.
I'll entertain a motion unless someone wants to discuss more. Unless there are objections, I'm going to open it up to our visitor. Did
sure.
you have something to add first?
No, I was going to make a motion, but we can do that after.
Okay. All right, we'll suspend the rules. Is there anyone who'd like to speak?
So, Shalee, 350 Taft Street. When I first talked, I did say the notification was one of my issues that I would like addressed, and you are addressing that, so thank you. Second was the severity of the cases coming here. I was worried about that. My logic tells me if Green Bay denies them, where are they going to go? Here. And we have have no residency rule other than 50 feet of loitering, and I know. You said there is one?
Oh, there's a high density residency issue.
Oh, yeah, like in more than one household. Okay. And then my third issue is where we're going forward here in the neighborhoods. The density in the affordable neighborhoods like Taft Street along Webster. I feel like our neighborhood could go down the drain. And I don't want that to happen. It's a nice neighborhood, but it happens if you look where they're located. That's the density I want you, if you're looking about placing, if they come to the board and they say, we want to move here, watch where you're putting them so that a whole neighborhood doesn't go down because you have so many in one neighborhood. And we're taking that front because we're an affordable neighborhood. I said before, they're not moving into the ritzy neighborhoods as much because it's expensive. Your logic tells you we have a lot of young families, and you talk about the neighborhood watch. We used to have block off of the street, and we had a picnic in the right on the street, put the barricades out. We had a Taft Street Carnival. We had 30 kids all come down, and we would play. Every year we had a Taft Street Carnival. Now we have young people. You know, talked before. She's a young girl, maybe wanting to have a family someday. I don't see it people staying. The girl across the street from me is a young girl. She has a boyfriend. They're going to get married. They're not going to stay and have a family there. We see it happening in our neighborhood. The affordable neighborhoods where young families would move and have a family, they're not going to come to Alloway. We're an older community. And our street is one of the first turning over because we're maybe 1950s. And you're going to have it happen throughout Alloway. We're kind of a precedent. And moving forward here, do you want families to move here? They're not going to be able to or want to in the affordable neighborhoods because there's sex offenders living there. Our neighbor put their house up for sale. He was one of the people that spoke, and they just can't live there. And they put their house up for sale, and they ethically can't feel like they could sell the house without telling the people who lives next door to them. So they have, and they've had three offers rescinded. It's affecting property values. The realtor told them, your house already went down $15,000. You can't even list it, you know, whatever. So you're going to have to look at a lot of things when you're looking at where you're going forward with this all. That's what I want to say.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to speak? Yes, ma'am.
I'm Suzanne Fox. That's my husband Jim, and we own the house at 326 Taft Street, and we're a couple houses this way too. I had renters with three children that just moved out 2 months before their lease was up, and they're gone this weekend. I couldn't hold them to a lease. They had a four-year-old boy and a daughter that was the right age for this gentleman and another son. And I'm a mother. I had to let them go. So I know that none of you have a sex offender on your block because you wouldn't have the relaxed look that you have in your eyes if you did. And he's not going to mess with a child right next door. He's going to go someplace else. One of the things that I heard today was that they thrive when they have supervision. And I have a question about that. They have supervision because people are watching them all the time. It doesn't mean they're cured. It doesn't mean they don't want to do it. It doesn't mean they're not thinking about it 24/7. It just means they have not yet had the opportunity. And as a survivor of this situation, being 11 and having a man in his 60s still chasing after young girls, when you think about this, those four little girls that were sitting here today is that man's prey. And that's what you're letting into the community, to be fair, because they have to live somewhere. Well, somewhere shouldn't be with our children. They're not curable. and they're not decent to live with. And I'm not talking about every sex offender. I'm not talking about the kid in 20s that got mixed up with a girl in 14. I'm talking about predators. People that can't be cured and will never live a decent life. And that's what you've left move into Tap Street. I don't know what we're going to do with our property. Because like Brandon next to Sue, I feel morally obligated to tell every renter that wants to move into my house that there is a predator five houses down. And we're stuck with that. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak?
Yes, sir.
Mark Sudi, 350 Tap Street. You know, I've been kind of gathering information with you folks, and I kind of like to share it with you and pass it on. You know, for what it's worth, you know, it's not scientific, but I have some various information. You're trying to grapple with the growth of this, of the claims in Alloway, and I had a study from Robert Horinchek that was in the paper from 2011, and he had where in Green Bay, they're percentage of offenses dropped from 68% of the population to 62%. And that goes from 2007 to 2011. So, you know, that's telling me that, you know, I guess you saw already in the current data that Alloway or Green Bay is dropping, and, you know, the question is where they're going. During that time, and back in about in 2012, Green Bay was looking at their ordinance, and they were lobbied by the Brown County Police Department and the Department of Corrections to loosen it, to go back to where they were before, the restrictive ordinance. And upon spending quite a bit of time on it, Green Bay decided to go even more strict, and that was in the summer of 2012. So maybe that's dovetailing into your data that you're seeing a spike in. The head of Department of Corrections, Jed Newman, at the time was saying, he said, we feel like real estate agents trying to locate these offenders. And if Green Bay keeps their strict policy, you know, what real estate are they going to? It kind of looks like they might be heading in our direction. Part of the, when Green Bay Board reviews their offenses, I've got numbers that they approve 60% and disapprove 40. You know, and it looks like the 40 are the, you know, the number of the higher risk cases. Interesting, I was looking in the Valley. They have the Post Crescent had an article of Police Department in the Fox Valley Metro Police Department. Interestingly, that's Kimberly and Little Chute and their group. They're 180 degrees different than Brown County as far as their emphasis on what approach to take. You know, I guess what approach do we take? But anyway, their officer, Police Chief David Peterson, basically went just the opposite way. And he said, you know, it's hard to prove which way to go, but he said, I'm going to err on the side of safety. So I thought that sort of kind of hit me. Let's see. I know in looking at this, oh, here's another example. In Milwaukee, I don't know if you're aware, just in the last week, their folks down there, the city of Milwaukee, lobbied the state to restrict offenders in their jurisdiction because they felt they were getting more offenders than the outlying communities. They have an open policy, and their suburbs have a restrict policy, just the opposite of what we have here. I guess in the when you're looking at making a decision of which way to go, what kind of policy you have, restrictive or non-restrictive, you're looking at weighing the costs and benefits. You know, the benefits are you keep control, you have a awareness of where this offender is. And on the other side of the equation, the costs, I guess I'm kind of, you know, I'm kind of living it as a kind of a quasi-expert. The stress on the community is is definite and measurable in the neighborhood. And I don't know how you put a measure on that cost, but it's significant. I had one neighbor, he was so upset, he took his blood pressure and it was just through the roof. And I had another one that had flashbacks to when he was a kid and he saw a child get killed in a car accident. And it was something he suppressed in his memory. It's very, very severe, very measurable. But then we also have older folks that are very tolerant, very accepting. They want to give them every chance in the world. You know, it just depends on the folks. But, you know, the bottom line is it's hardest on the younger folks and the family folks. And how, you know, how can you blame them? I guess, you know, I can ramble on some more. I'm sorry to do that. I don't know if you had a chance to read this, but it's kind of interesting. Officer Lucknow has it. It's it's a summary of the state puts out, and it talks about living with sex offenders. I guess when you know, I was kind of stuck in this position, it's the last thing I want to talk about, but I was kind of just felt like I was thrust into it. I was looking for a guide, you know, a guide to how to live next to a sex offender, I guess, for lack of a better word. So I was looking through this, and, you know, in here it has things like truth or fact or fiction. Sex offenders are committed by strangers, and it says 90% of the time they know their victim, so they're familiar with them. So that tells me, you know, if they're closer to you, they might have to know you. And you know, another one statistic here says sexual assaults are a spur of the moment, and over 70% they're planned. So is it easier to plan when you're living right next to somebody? And it sort of tells me it likely is. One thing I guess if you guys could help me with is, how is it that so many folks are saying that it doesn't matter where the sex offender lives, because he can offend you, you know, drive to anywhere and offend you? I don't know. I guess I don't know where that's coming from. I don't quite understand that. You know, from what I'm looking at here, it's just, it's hard to understand. I'm sorry, I'm kind of rambling here.
Not at all.
But I'll just, you know, leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak? Hearing none, we'll take up the rules. Again, this is a very difficult issue. I don't pretend to know exactly what it's like, you're right, to be living next to or have my children exposed to someone who's a sex offender. My goal in all of this comes back to the research that I've quoted before, is I would much rather know that there's someone in my neighborhood who's an offender and teach my kids how to interact or not interact with that person, than to have someone living in my neighborhood who my kids think is just a nice gentleman down the street who is an offender. I mean, I would hate to think that they would get lured into a situation because they didn't know and I didn't know. And, you know, I'm sympathetic with the fact that, especially from these data, that there could be some disproportionality, which makes me want to look back at the residents. I don't know. If anyone on this board, if they have they'd like to hear about it, is that it doesn't matter where the residents live. I think it very much does. The research in the pamphlet suggests that it's usually someone that knows the victim. So you're right, it very much does impact, or it does matter where the offender lives. It's just, I always come back to, I'd rather know where the person is than not know. And again, I can't pretend to know what it's like to live in one of these neighborhoods. So if I've ever communicated the idea that I know exactly what it's like, I clearly don't. I can't even pretend to. Other comments by the board? Trustee Gass.
Sure, I'll make a three-part motion. First part is to direct DO Lucknow to report back to the board at the next meeting concerning recommendations concerning notice based upon severity of offense. And by that I mean the more severe offenses, in your estimation, would get individualized notice to the local residents versus other kinds of notice for the less severe or less significant offenses. So that takes care of the notice part. Second part of the motion is to refer to Village Council the issue of drafting and adopting an ordinance under which if any other municipal jurisdiction rejects a particular offender as being allowed to reside within their geographical limitations, that they are automatically barred from the Village of Alloway. And the third part of the motion is that for the next meeting we have the actual residency restriction ordinance and the density ordinance back before the board so that we can take a look at the actual language and have discussion concerning whether we want to alter or modify the existing ordinance restrictions.
I'll second. Discussion? Trustee Gatz, do you have anything? Is there any additional information that we need from DEO LOP now to move forward with these decisions?
Do we want to look at, I think it was Trustee Dart who brought up the most recent cases and look at the severity of those?
I would like to have that information.
Do you want some comparison? So if the most recent cases in the past 6 months, we have a certain percent of pretty egregious.
We only have six of them, so I don't know what you compare them to, but if they're all, you know, I'll first go back to last, say, 2 years, and I'll list those specific ones
and their offenses, so you get an idea what they are.
If I, if I may,
please.
If we look at, I'd say the last 12 months rather than the 2 years, because that's when we're seeing, about a year ago it was, what, 19, and now we're at 29. So that's when we're seeing the jump. Mm-hmm. So I'd be most interested in what's happened in the last, the types of offenses in the last 12 months.
But if you got the last 2 years, we could break it up. We could break it up.
Okay, yes.
Okay. Any other information that you'd like to yield up now to gather? Further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
I just add one thing.
Yes.
Informational note. If anybody on the board or in the audience hasn't had a chance to do so, I still think the website www.wiucoffenders.org is probably the best resource I've seen as far as answering questions of notification and also to sign up with your email address to get notifications. And if it's done, if someone registers, obviously it's not necessarily beforehand, but at least it's one form. And, you know, I believe most people have access to the internet email these days. It's a very simple thing to do.